Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and today we're going to be talking about the long-term effects of trauma on infant mental health. Our guest today, Dr. Tony Dobner, a child and adolescent psychiatrist. Dr. Dobner, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having us, Larry.
And Cheryl Cato, a great friend who's been with us many times. She's a child and family therapist. She's director of the Rainbow Project. It's a child and family counseling and resource clinic located in Madison. Cheryl's also a clinical adjunct professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Cheryl, good to see you again.
Yes, wonderful to be here.
Questions for them as we talk about this whole area of infant mental health. I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Cheryl, let's go back to the Rainbow Project. Talk about it for a bit. Tell us about it.
Well, last month we celebrated our 38th year serving the community and serving over 13,000 children since we began. And our first day we opened, we had a waiting list. We were full, and we've never not had
a waiting list.
So we are certainly, our services are unfortunately in demand, but we work and specialize with young children and families who have experienced trauma, and that would include abuse and neglect and domestic violence, community violence, but I think lesser known. We also work with young children where there is grief or loss in separation, natural disasters or emergency kinds of accidents that might happen, as well as drug-endangered children. There is, unfortunately, child sex trafficking, and so any other kinds of traumas, including relationship challenges with a parent and a child.
Well, Dr. Dobner, you did a rotation, I believe, at the Rainbow Project. What was your experience like there?
Yeah, that's correct, Larry. I'm currently working at Rainbow Project with Cheryl on Monday afternoons once a week. I started there in July, and I'll be there through the end of October. And it's been a really interesting experience. I always knew about their outpatient clinic and the resource that they are to the community on East Washington here in Madison. What I learned more about was all the different ways that they serve the community through their outreach, crisis, intervention and assessment when different disasters or traumatic experiences happen in the community. That was one thing I didn't know about that I think is really awesome that Rainbow Project engages in with the community.
Yeah. You know, I think there's an impression that young children don't develop mental health problems and that they're somehow immune, maybe in a way, to these effects of early adversity, and maybe they're just going to grow out of it or whatever. And That's true.
I think when we think about developmental delays physically, for example, we all kind of know those milestones, that turning over when they're an infant or being able to walk or grab things. But I think mental health is less known and understood. And so we're hoping that more of those developmental milestones will be known so that, at this month, 3 months, or at 6 months, not that there aren't individual differences, not that there aren't some genetic differences or temperaments, but in general, identifying earlier on if there are some chronic problems that can be addressed, the earlier the better.
Does there research on, for example, the extent of this in that infant population or that young population?
Well, there certainly is. And that's something that we're proud of at the Rainbow Project, because when we began in 1980, we certainly were very much committed to doing something in the community that addressed some of those issues. So John Bowlby and Alicia Lieberman and Terry Razelton and so many others. Stanley Greenspan was doing a great deal of work in emotional and social development, for example, within infants, and really helping us understand those milestones.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Dobner, maybe I can talk with you a little bit. What does it look like? Are there, how does it present in young
Yeah, that's a great question, Larry. And the way that you described, you know, how maybe the general public may think about infants and their mental health in general was really like how I thought about infant mental health, even until I began my training here in psychiatry early on when I worked mostly with adults in the hospital setting. Occasionally we would get a call about a concern for a very young child or an infant, and I would wonder, I would kind of scratch my head, what am I supposed to do in this type of situation? And it wasn't really through my training when I learned more about attachment theory and research that, you know, a lot of which was conducted here at our university and in our psychiatry department, and that's ongoing to this day. I really began to appreciate how even in the earliest days of life, through some of the earliest attachments between the primary attachment figures, the parents and the infant, infants are starting to learn how to think about the world and how to process emotions and deal with stressors.
Yeah. And so you see it expressed, Cheryl, at the Rainbow Project at times?
Yes. Oh, yes. And I think because infants are really so dependent on their caregivers for just physical needs, as well as a source for joy and safety when that isn't there. Sometimes we've actually seen infants who appear deaf because they're not responding to the usual stimuli, and it's because they've kind of given up, not crying because no one has ever responded to those needs, and that's the kind of attunement that we really think that is what provides that secure base for infants, because without that, the other areas of development are really on a shaky foundation. We think that even infants can be clinically depressed, and I think that's sometimes something that people aren't aware of. And we're so hoping, and it doesn't take as long, to intervene and really be able to strengthen that child's ability, that infant's ability to get back on track.
Yeah, and if they don't get back on track and it's not noticed, this has got to express itself then later as you may not know, you know, a psychiatrist looking at a 15-year-old may not know that.
Yes, that's a good point. We look at that chronologically. We're all at a certain level, age, but when we developmentally have many different parts of the development, and cognitively we're at one place, physically we're at another, socially and emotionally at another, so very much so you could have a 15-year-old who may even be in some time socially and emotionally at a 15-month-old level. Mm-hmm. So it really is important to be able to assess and evaluate where that is. I mean, something as simple as rocking and being able to console is eventually internalized. So really, infants, if they have that love source, will really be able to not only love others, but to love themselves and trust themselves much better.
Yeah, and I just want to add, some of those signs of early depression can be seen even earlier than adolescence. A lot of what we know about infant mental health issues, we know from studies on postpartum depression and how that can affect infants and toddlers. Even in their earliest days, we know from studies of parents and children, some studies going on 5 years, that infants of parents that are depressed can have even physical manifestations of illness. They're more likely to have asthma, colic, early diabetes, childhood diabetes, increased episodes of diarrhea frequency, and even changes to personality and temperament. Children that grew up with parents with depression are more likely to have behavioral problems when they go into daycare or school, ADHD, oppositional defiant disorder, sleep problems, anxiety, depression. So,
well, and I also, I think that something simple as rocking helps develop our central nervous system as infants, and later on, we really rely on our central nervous system to help us in controlling violent behavior, being able to regulate our emotions and our actions, and so all of those kinds of research now are helping us understand more how we can fortify infants and really restore some of the trust that they may have lost.
Yeah.
That's a great point, Cheryl. Even in infants' earliest days, they have preferential attention to the parent, to the mother versus other adults. And they particularly pay really close attention to upward, you know, smiling mouths, we know from just tracking where their eyes will go when they're shown different images. And so they're really learning how to emotionally regulate and process, even in their earliest days.
Wow. Well, we have several callers online with questions or comments. We'll go to Madison, talk with John. John, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I kind of two-part thing is I have recently adopted. It's been a 2.5-year process through the foster care program. Twin, they're 3.5 now, but they spent a year with their drug-affected birth mother, and the effects of, I would say, neglect and experiencing traumatic events while a less than year old had really profound impacts developmentally, and that it took us even longer to figure out and have a recommendation on. This is where I want your comments, is on play therapy at that age, where they can't communicate, but the way that they play reflects their experiences, and it really helped us understand what the trigger points were for food or attention or being wet and cold. We learned that they had been co-slept, and as infants would roll on the floor when mom is passed out on the bed and be on the floor for hours and hours at a time, wet and cold and hungry as newborns. And we learned that, and so now we're able to better understand. And I just wonder if there's, you know, if you have had those experiences and can elaborate a little bit more on that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I will comment that you sound very attuned and able to articulate some of the important things that we do see. And there are children that young who have emotional memories, if not specific ones, as well as certain sounds or sights that even trigger certain memories or emotional responses. So I think that kind of says a lot when we're thinking about trauma and some of the research, which is the bad news is that can impact neurobiology and brain development. But the good news is that also persistent and consistent, you know, being able to be in a nurturing, attuned environment can actually reverse some of those negative impacts. And so that's the hopeful part.
Yeah.
It can be very challenging to do that and to find play is the natural language for young children. And there were maybe words that just cannot be found to express the experiences that they have had. So it is really a vital part of what we do, because I think telling the, being able to publicly express the personal pain that they've experienced is really the first sign of really restoring and recovering from that trauma. So play is definitely, play therapy is an important part of that solution.
You were going to add to that, Dr. Dobner?
Yeah, I think the caller, you know, to answer the caller's question, I think we do see these patterns and some of these early life disruptions in attachment can lead to some of these problems. But I do want to make a point that we know from a lot of studies, a lot of what we know comes from studies of children raised in Romanian orphanages for their childhood. And what we know is that reactive attachment disorders are rare, and the typical response, even to extreme neglect, is actually resilience. So most children will be able to develop attachments in the future. For those children that do have signs of reactive attachment disorder, the most effective treatment is actually early intervention. being placed in a loving family and having opportunities for those secure attachments to form. So I think it's really wonderful that the caller was able to notice some of those signs mm-hmm. and get their child engaged with play therapy, which is something that Cheryl Cato and her colleagues at Rainbow Clinic are using, and it's really effective.
Yeah. John, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call, and we'll get to Judy and Ripon next. But first, a reminder, our guest today, Cheryl Cato, is child and family therapist, director of the Rainbow Project, also clinical adjunct professor in the Department of Psychiatry. Anthony Dobner, Dr. Dobner, a child and adolescent psychiatrist. Our guest here today, I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at infant mental health today with our two guests, Cheryl Cato of the Rainbow Project of Madison. She's also an adjunct professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the UW. And Dr. Anthony Dobner, an MD and child and adolescent psychiatrist. So, experiences to share or questions to ask as we talk about infant mental health, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to Judy and Ripon next. Judy, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to say that we were very, very fortunate as parents that we had the financial resources and insurance to do this, but I would recommend it to everybody if they could, and I'd love to see it if the American Academy of Pediatrics would pick this up as a recommendation, that children be seen from, you know, infancy on by a mental health worker, preferably an MD, like a, you know, like a child psychiatrist or adolescent psychiatrist, so that they know and have established a relationship with a family. And it would be done like a well child care check. Like, you take your children on a regular basis to the pediatrician. You would be taking your child on a regular basis to a psychiatrist, because when the problems arrive or trauma happens, now the psychiatrist has known this family all along, just like a pediatrician does, and they know the person, they know the family, they know the background, they've got notes, you know, in their files on what's been going on. We did this with our kids, even though they didn't have any trauma or anything like that in their lives. But my family suffers from, you know, depression, anxiety. We've got alcoholism in the past in our family. And so we took our children to a psychiatrist from very little on. And so when they did, my son, for example, had a lot of issues with anxiety and depression all through college, and maintained the relationship with the psychiatrist who knew him from baby on. And it was the most wonderful thing for continuity. And I, like I said, I know that so many people aren't able to do this financially, but if there was some way that we could get this into well child checks, get a relationship established, and then the child doesn't have to think, gosh, there's something wrong with me, I'm seeing a psychiatrist. Well, I've seen the psychiatrist since I was two, so there's yeah. nothing weird about it.
Yeah, well, you raise a really interesting point. Cheryl, I will have you both comment, but Cheryl, we'll start with you.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly, and I think that kind of proactive work is definitely needed. Too much of the time, practice and policy lag behind the research, and we also need to be creative in how we fund these things for everyone, and I think that that's exactly what is needed. There are so many resiliency and protective factors also that can be strengthened when what you are describing happens, so that you are really inoculating children for them to have that really good foundation when something does happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dr. Dabner, you?
Yeah, the caller makes a really great point. I do want to say that the majority of psychiatric illnesses in, I think, in children and adults are treated by primary care providers. They're the number one prescribers of psychiatric medications. And I think my colleagues in primary care do a really excellent job. A lot of them are very savvy and knowledgeable and really great at treating mental illnesses. I think a lot of them will say that if there's one area where they wish they could maybe have like a booster course. A lot of them will say they wish that they knew more about psychiatric illnesses. And I think because the need is so great, I think the state of the future going forward is really going towards an integrated care and collaborative care model where you have mental health providers, psychologists, and psychiatrists embedded in primary care clinics, where you have the mental health care provider's desk right across from the pediatrician's desk. And then they can just get curbside consultation and collaborate on taking care of patients in the community.
I think particularly since there is such a high correlation, not only with trauma, but with other psychological issues that impact also the physical somatic illnesses. So we have much more in terms of childhood obesity and other factors that are related sometimes to the psychological difficulties. So that kind of integrated care is so so needed. So I appreciate the callers.
The other thing that strikes me about it is that there's sometimes there's this thought about, we had to send him to a psychiatrist or something. So there's that attitude that it isn't just part of a normal health assessment. And I think it could go, if this continue, you know, what you're talking about could be expanded or develop, or as it develops, that maybe that sort of stigma stuff will be at least lessened.
Yes, it is. It is a stigma. And I think that sometimes culturally, too, there are differences. So we really, I think using the terms well-being or behavioral health sometimes is helpful in breaking down some of those barriers. But we're also really excited that there are more referrals of self-referrals of parents coming forward and saying, I'm not waiting until she's 14. I cannot handle her now at 2. And that stigma of children's mental health is a little less. And so that they are being able to initiate it is really helpful.
Well, let's take another call. Glenn in on the road to Rochester, Minnesota. Let's go there. Hi, Glenn.
Yes, hi. Good morning. So I have a son. He's now 21. We adopted him when he was 6 months old. And by the time he was 2, the whole family was in therapy, trying to manage his behavior. And through the years, he has never been without psychiatric and therapeutic interventions, all of which he very strategically and deliberately undermined. Now, we lived in New York at the time, and we did have the resources of a school where he had individual therapy every week, group therapy a couple times a week, and eventually he was in a residential facility run by the same people who did the day school. But about 6 years ago, there was a New York Times Magazine cover story about sociopathy, is that the right word, in children. You know, there had been such reluctance to use the words sociopathy in relation to children. And as I read this article, it was like, oh my God, these people had 20 years of every psychiatric and therapeutic intervention with no results, no positive results. And actually, when he finally went to the boarding school, it was absolutely necessary because it was necessary that he leave the home. And I just wondered if there is any additional information or growth in that area of recognizing that there are sociopathic children. They don't necessarily grow up to be criminals, but they do have a lack of ability to empathize. They're very unaware of the effect that their behavior has on their environment. And I think a lot of the very root problems with these children is kind of different from
the others.
Stuff that you do with more normal children. And I just wonder if there's anything in that field that's coming forth.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm sorry for the, for, I'm sorry for the for your son and for the all of the problems that he's had, and obviously you and your family have had as well. Dr. Dobner, let's go to you. Comments from you first? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, the caller brings up a great question. Unfortunately, there isn't a lot of information about sociopathy in children. I think it's an area of ongoing research right now. And I think the state of the research isn't at a point where we can really make treatment decisions or use the information that we know to guide our treatments. You know, parents will ask me questions similar to the caller's question about their child who may be having some disruptive behaviors, maybe getting into trouble at school. And I can see, I can definitely feel where their worries are coming from. No parent wants their child to grow up or see these behaviors that can be disruptive progress into adulthood. I do not use the label sociopath or antisocial personality disorder in children based on the DSM-5, which is the manual that we use to make our diagnoses. Someone can't be diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder until after they turn 18 years old. What we know from adults that have that diagnosis, they were probably much more likely to have depression, mood disorder, maybe early substance use disorder as children. Some like very young children may display some signs that like two adults would look like sociopathy, but it's really important for us to keep child development in mind and our knowledge of developmental milestones, because some behaviors like lying, for example, in a toddler could be a normal behavior just because that's the developmental stage that they're at that point.
Yeah.
And I've seen symptoms described, and they could be very interchangeable with other kinds of labels. And so we just, as working with young children, are very cautious about doing that. But I think that there could be so many other areas. That's why the attachment and trust is so fundamental, because the ability to be compassionate and empathize with others is something that is a developmental issue and is not necessarily a forever issue either, that may appear that way. And there is also a complication with the multifaceted parts of continuum of Asperger's and autism too, where there may not be the social kinds of responses that you would normally see, and that doesn't mean necessarily that they are a different kind of label either. So just really seeing the multifaceted parts to that.
Glenn, I thank you very much for calling and appreciate your call very much. And we'll let others join in. You can join in. We'll go to Donna Milwaukee next, but you can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Don, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What's on your mind today?
Yeah, I have a 13-year-old daughter that we adopted when she was three. She was diagnosed with RADS. And we've been seeing a child psychologist since we got her. Same psychologist since we got her. And we're still having problems with the attachment. You know, it just seems like it's not there. And I guess I was looking for maybe some clues on how I can get her to stop stealing and lying and sneaking and not doing her homework. You know, I'm having a hard time really thinking of consequences for this. You know, most of our consequences are having her do something physical or making up for the stealing and stuff like that. But it still seems like it's a long road that's...
Well, Cheryl, let's turn to you for a bit. Have you got some advice for Don or help?
Well, I do think that history of trauma when you with adoption is sometimes unknown. So that can be also a challenge if you're not sure of the specifics or the details of what went on in terms of help. But I'm glad that you are still, you know, searching for the different ways. I don't know what the specific kinds of consequences are, but I'm also very familiar with trauma victims and how punitive or negative responses may actually not be helpful. And so it's, I'm saying things not knowing the details of it. But I think sometimes rewarding when things happen well, that are doing well, can counter some of the self-concept of the world is not safe. I'm going to do something first, be negatively to defend myself. It's kind of when trauma is there and occurring, it's like the adrenaline we all experience, but they don't turn it off. They can't turn it off. And so you're going to have those kinds of behaviors sometimes, and it's so challenging. Just as with the other caller, I am so impressed when families are seeking their own support in counseling, because it is a challenge to be able to work in this, you know, when a child is demonstrating these behaviors. So I would look at some of the alternatives in terms of how you respond to some of the negative behaviors.
Yeah. I don't know if
I just want to thank the caller for bringing this issue to our attention. I think it's really good that you've continued to work with the psychologist over these years. It's great that they made an accurate diagnosis of reactive attachment disorder. Sometimes these kids will be mislabeled as being bipolar or ADHD or autism or some other diagnosis that doesn't really get to the underlying attachment injury. And I'd encourage Don to stick with it and continue working with the psychologist. It can be a long road. Children with reactive attachment disorder will probably need a lot of remediation of some of the skills that they're working on in therapy. In terms of parental, different things you can do that can be helpful, we know from a lot of research that kids respond the best to structure and consistency. So you don't have to say the perfect thing every time, you just have to say the right thing every time in response to the particular behavior that you're seeing. And then I just want to reflect what Cheryl was saying. Well, as well as we know, positive reinforcement is a lot more effective than punishment. Certain like very disruptive behaviors need consequences. But adding in some type of positive reinforcer or praise for good behavior will go a long way to strengthen the attachment relationship and guide behavior going forward in the future.
This may be totally off, but as you were talking, I was thinking about the Dr. Patricia McConnell, who comes on my show to talk about dealing with pets. And the positive reinforcement works the best there as well. And so I think that's a great idea to make sure that you're positively reinforcing good behavior.
Well, I think many of the children that we work with already are feeling like damaged goods when they have been victims of trauma. So you're kind of reinforcing that. And it's almost a distraction from very well-intentioned responses and very caring responses, and yet not helpful in having them develop a different kind of self-concept and identity.
Don, I wish you well, and I wish your child well as well. And thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Judy emailed to say her twins were born 8 weeks early, and they spent 6 weeks in the hospital. She wonders what long-term effects that has had on them. Here they are. This is 14 years later.
Yeah, that's a great question. In my experiences on the child psychiatry consult service at UW, the youngest patient I ever saw was an 18-month-old, and a lot of times if the infant is having a lot of mood reactivity, sometimes we'll get consulted. And so sometimes attachment insecurity can develop in response to, you know, if there are a lot of very severe medical illnesses that cause a child to have to be, you know, in the NICU or the pediatric ICU for an extended period of time, and the cares that they require in the hospital cause some separation from the parental attachment figure. That can cause some separation anxiety. But the good news is that it sounds like after that initial 6 weeks, the child was reunited with the mother. And so children are very resilient, and you know, attachment is the best treatment for reactive attachment. So I think that there's probably a good chance that this child won't develop any significant problems based on that early disruption. And hospitals these days, you know, like years ago, I think when my grandparents had babies, the hospital administrators and doctors used to think that, you know, it would be unsanitary for the infant and mother to be together. So they would like separate the infant and they'd be cared for by nurses and things like that instead of by the mother. But as we've learned more and more about attachment theory, we know that that's kind of backwards. And so hospitals like the American Family Children's Hospital really try to encourage parents to be in the hospital. The rooms are very large, so that the whole family could stay in the hospital with the child if they need to. And then in the NICU and the pediatric ICU, they try to use the primary nursing model, where if the parent isn't able to be there for whatever reason, they try to have consistent staffing, one nurse working with the infant to nurture attachment. And that's been shown to be really helpful.
You know, here we're getting close to the end of time, and I know that there's an event coming up that I certainly want to mention, Cheryl, and can you talk about it?
Sure. We are actually, although we are 38 years old, our fundraising annual event is the 14th. It's called Rumble for Rainbow, and we are having it at the UW Union South this Friday, September 21st, from 7 p.m. to midnight, and we're having lots and lots of wonderful, we believe in fun in fundraising, and we definitely need to raise funds, but it's also really a good way to celebrate coming together and supporting very courageous families doing some really hard work restoring from lots of trauma. So we really want to provide the goodwill and support from our stakeholders and supporters as well when we come together.
Is there a place where people go if they want to come?
Yes, online we have www.therainbowproject.net, all one word, and that will take you over to the Rumble for Rainbow website, and you can get tickets and come.
Go from there. Therainbowproject.org.
Yes.
Correct?
.net.
.net. Ah, see, therainbowproject.net is the proper. And I'm sorry we're not getting to everybody. I know we had a teacher who wondered about how do you work with kids, the one or two in a classroom that may have behavior issues. And
well, I think we are here in the Dane County area have a children's mental health collaborative that's really trying to pair and partner mental health services with the schools, and really impressed with that partnership in order to really help strengthen the ability to provide what's needed in the schools. That early intervention is so critical and so important, and we're providing a lot more prevention at the Rainbow Project, not just at the very high risk kinds of situations, in order to really strengthen the resiliency.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for taking time to be with us today. I learned a lot, and I really appreciate all the calls, and sorry we didn't get to everybody today, but kind of that's the way it is. You'll have to come back and be with us again.
Sounds good.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Cheryl Cato is a child and family therapist, a director of the Rainbow Project, also a clinical adjunct professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, Dr. Anthony Dobner, an MD, and a child and adolescent psychiatrist. Great to have them along, and we'll see if we can do, we will do some more with them in the future. And thank you so much for listening in. Coming up, we're going to be talking with you about the latest research on atrial fibrillation. That next, here on the Ideas Network.